series of lectures which I'm dealing with now, we're going to see how the high priest, who, as I mentioned, beginning with Alexander's day, emerged as sort of the representative of the Jewish people of Judea to the, whoever was their ruler. And he was sort of the functioning political or civil head, as well as religious leader. How that role began to go through certain major changes in this particular period of time. And so we'll take several lectures to develop that point, but this is the main reason why we're covering this particular area of time so intensely. Now let's briefly review the status of Judea as it existed under the Ptolemies. Under the Ptolemies, what was the status of Judea as far as administratively? How did the Ptolemies view it? How did the Ptolemies classify it? Roger?
It was like temple-owned land, so therefore you had to pay taxes as the other problem.
Okay. As temple-owned land, it was viewed as land that belonged to a particular god who had an earthly administrator. In this case, the high priest of Judea was viewed as that earthly administrator, and it was viewed as being very similar to the temple-owned lands in Egypt. Now, Roger mentioned they didn't have to pay taxes in the manner that other areas did. Did that mean they were tax-free? They had a complete tax exemption. Is that the situation? Kathy? Okay, there was a set figure set by the Ptolemaic administration, which the high priest was responsible for raising. But besides not having to endure tax farming, what other aspects of the Ptolemaic administration were the people of Judea spared? What did they not have to experience besides, you know, being subjected to tax farmers? Flavia? Right, and because they were spared all these foreigners coming in, which represented this very alien Hellenistic culture, they didn't have a whole lot of contact with this alien Hellenistic culture. That while all the other ethnic groups in the vicinity of Judea, the Moabites, the Edomites, the Ammonites, the Philistines, the Phoenicians, the Arameans, they all were becoming Hellenized, they were adopting the predominant Greek culture of the day. They were beginning to speak in Greek, to read the Greek classics of literature and philosophy, to practice the Greek form of athletics, to construct buildings in the Greek architectural style. Judea was still a distinct culture with its own religion, its own language, its own social and legal traditions. Therefore, you might say that it was sort of an island in a growing Hellenistic sea. So because of this special status, which was a fixed part of the Ptolemaic administration, Judea enjoyed total, you might say, religious and cultural autonomy. They were able to exist, as I say, this independently minded island in this growing Hellenistic sea. Now, what we need to do is leave the Ptolemaic administration in Judea for a minute and take a look and see what was going on in the Seleucid Empire during the period from 301 BC to approximately 201 BC. Remember, I said that about 301 BC, you had the establishment of the Ptolemaic kingdom in Egypt and the Seleucid Empire, you know, in the bulk of what had been Alexander's empire. And then we traced, you know, how the Ptolemies ruled their areas and how Judea fit into that. So we need to see what's going on here. Now, this is the Nile. I guess I should put Cyprus in there. Here we have Asia Minor. All the way to the Indus River. We have a vast expanse. Here's the border between the Ptolemaic. I should give this part also to the Ptolemies. This is being their border. I wish I had some colored chalk, but I don't. The rest of all this was the Seleucid Empire. Now, from the period of about 301 to about 220 BC, what happened in the Seleucid Empire, to summarize it very briefly, was steady dissolution. This was, remember, an enormous area, and it was highly complex, made up of many, many, many different ethnic groups, each with their own linguistic and religious and cultural traditions, which the Seleucids were trying to weld together under some form of unity, trying to impose Hellenistic civilization as sort of a cement over this very diverse area. But in this period, from 301 to 220, they lost control gradually of large chunks of their empire. And it was steadily shrinking because they just couldn't hold on to such a large, widely spread out, and highly diverse area. But in 220 BC, a man came to the throne who is known to history as Antiochus, or if you want to call it with the more Greek pronunciation, I think it's Antiochus. Oh no, that's the Hebrew pronunciation. Sorry, not the Greek. Antiochus the Great. And he was, like Alexander the Great, a great conqueror. That's why he earned this little attribution. And he restored all of these lost provinces, which had slipped away, and they had been, you know, an awful amount. You might say that almost the entire eastern half of their empire had fallen out of the Seleucid Empire. What he did was to reconquer all of these areas. And he began to impose a new administration, pattern of administration, you might say, on the empire to get a better handle on it, you might say. Now, what was that pattern of administration? Well, let me draw it for you with a little bit of pictorial representations. And you can see from my mat work, I'm not really a great artist, so you'll have to forgive me. There he is, King Antiochus. If I tried to draw anything closer, a closer approximation of a human form, it would even be funnier. So we'll just leave him that way. Basically, there were three major classifications of groups within the empire in terms of, you know, how the administration was handled. The most important to Antiochus, and the one with which he maintained, you might say, the closest relationship, this classification were the Hellenistic cities. Alexander had begun the process. I'd better give him another arm. Otherwise, he'll really look funny. Alexander had begun the process of founding cities in various places of his empire. For example, the city we know of is Alexandria, which carried his name in Egypt, was founded by him, and later grew to be one of the largest cities in the then-known world. I mean, it had a population twice that of Rome itself in the days of the Roman Empire, about 3 million people, a true metropolis. These Hellenistic cities were founded by Greek or Macedonian colonists, and then, of course, they drew to themselves a lot of the native inhabitants who they admitted, as we've already seen in that handout I gave you, on a basis of full legal and social equality if they adopted Greek culture. So these became islands of Greek culture in these foreign seas, and they began to spread their influence out to the surrounding countryside in an effort to win these local people over to the Hellenistic way of things. Now, because they were so essential to Antiochus and as instruments of spreading this culture, which they hoped would be the cement which would bind the empire together, they had a great number of privileges. Each was guaranteed full political, internal self-government by charter. In other words, each of these Hellenistic cities was given a charter by the ruler which guaranteed that they could run their own internal affairs as they saw fit. They were also given many tax exemptions, because again, they were viewed in a very favorable light by the government as things which could encourage unity in this very diverse area. They were also given various trading, perks, I guess I'll call them. In other words, sometimes outright monopolies in certain areas because they were a Hellenistic city. Other cases, they were given preferential treatment or the first right to first bidding on certain products because they were a Hellenistic city. And then, in terms of the leading citizens of the city, if they traveled, they were given, the highest, red carpet treatment wherever they traveled. Now, the main reason that Antiochus was willing to deal with these cities in such a generous fashion, because obviously, this cost him something to do these things, is that he wanted to encourage other areas to establish themselves as a Hellenistic city. Now, the technical term for a Greek city or Hellenistic city, borrowing from the Greek word, is polis, or Greek. The word city in Greek is polis. We still use that somewhat today when we speak about a metropolis. Only we say metropolis. You see, we still use that. And of course, some of our cities in the United States still have this word polis stuck on the end of it. Though I was very much amused when in one of the classes I was teaching, the question was asked to the students to identify the twin cities, and the answer came back Minneapolis and Indianapolis. Because they both end in P-O-L-I-S, so they thought they were the twin cities. If that's horrific, you should see some of the things that AC students have done when it comes to geography. I still remember Mr. Ames giving a test to the sophomore class. It was an outline map of Europe, and people had to fill in the names of the countries. And one student didn't quite recognize that Britain was an island because they took the space, which is the Netherlands, and labeled it Britain. And I think Ireland was labeled Norway on another map. And the thing that was the oddest to me was that Switzerland was labeled Saudi Arabia. The Saudis should be so lucky. Anyway, how did I get on? Lack of knowledge of geography. Okay. I think, though, the most common error on that map was a tendency to switch Romania and Poland. Anyway, this was a tremendous advantage. It gave them distinct advantages above all others, and therefore was a tremendous magnet, these advantages, for encouraging even upper-class native peoples in various parts of the empire, even if they didn't have any Greek people around, to organize themselves as a Hellenistic polis, to adopt the Greek language and ask for people to, you know, for tutors and teachers to come and teach them Greek ways. So even if they didn't have a large number of Greeks in their area, many native peoples, desiring these privileges, organized themselves in this way. And this is why, of course, he was using this particular bait, you might say, to encourage this. Now, the second major... this is a very strange arm, I know. The second major classification, you might say, for the empire's administration, better give him another arm as well, was a group where you had what were called, let me put the two over here, okay, vassal kingdoms. Now, why were these groups classified in this fashion? Because they were a distinct ethnic group living in a compact area. Like, let's take Armenia, for example. You have a distinct ethnic group, the Armenians. They're living all in this area called Armenia. So they would fit in this classification. And the way they were administered is that they were ruled by a native king appointed by the Seleucid ruler. And they had considerable autonomy. Assuming they stayed loyal, so I say if loyal. But they had no other privileges. Because throughout the vast expanse of this empire, there were loads of such ethnic groups that lived in a relatively clearly defined area where they were the majority ethnic group, and they had, you know, their own leadership, you might say, their own royal family that they traditionally had looked to. And so Antiochus just selected a member of that royal family and said, I recognize you as king over this area, and you may have a certain amount of autonomy here, but no other privileges. You pay full taxes, no trading privileges, and if your citizens travel, they're just part of the common herd. They don't get any red carpet treatment. So there was, as you see, a little bit different relationship. This was more of an equal partnership sharing, and this was more of a superior-inferior kind of relationship. If a king were to die, normally his son would be the successor, normally, but it wasn't automatic. The Seleucid ruler would have to look at the new candidate and decide if he was worthy, and if he decided he was worthy, he'd say, okay, yes, you may inherit the throne. Otherwise, he would choose from among the other relatives of the dead king the one he liked best. So they weren't free to choose their own ruler by their own, by themselves, or just by right of succession, dynastic succession. The king had the final say of which of the relatives pleased him the most and would become the next ruler. Then we had the third classification in the empire, now I don't want to give him a smile, give him something intermediate. They can have a smile and he definitely has a frown. This classification was just known as the peoples, if I was going to translate it from the Greek, because ethnos. The word ethnic is, we get from the Greek word ethnos, a separate, distinct, you might say, national group. But rather than being, than dwelling together in a fairly compact area with a native king, which distinguished the vassal kingdoms, these were peoples that tended to be, what's the word I want? I can't think of the one word, I'll just use several. Spread out over large portions of the empire. And the way they were ruled is that the king recognized an individual as the representative of the ethnos to the king. And this person, because he was the representative of the ethnos to the king, and the representative from the king to the ethnos, it went both ways, the ones who communicated both ways, was the intermediary, he was known as the ethnarch. Arch, of course, archy, monarchy, oligarchy. What does arch mean in the Greek language?
Over.
Or government of, or governor. So governor of the ethnos, you see. So that's where the term came from. And it was viewed as being a title of honor, but it was not considered a royal title. It didn't have the same prestige as the word king, because he was simply the appointed representative of that ethnic group to the Seleucid ruler. And it was the king, of course, who appointed him. The people didn't choose their own ethnarch. It was chosen for them. The peoples had no self-government. They were totally under the rule of the Seleucid administration, and they had no privileges whatsoever. So you might see, you see why I put them in the position I did, because they had no special treatment whatsoever. They were the least favored group in the empire. Now, what happened that makes all this particularly relevant is that beginning in 220 BC, Antiochus began to reconquer various parts of his empire and subject it to this type of administration. And then once he had gotten a good handle on the situation, he was firmly in control of the empire. The borders of the empire had been restored to their former extent. Places like Mesopotamia and Bactria and the borders of India had been reincorporated back into the empire. He then began to look at this, He began to look at this area here, the border between his empire and the Ptolemaic Empire, where northern Syria was in his domain, and southern Syria was, of course, part of the, and of course Palestine, was part of the Ptolemaic Empire. He began to, you might say, cast covetous eyes in that direction. Now, why would he have been so motivated? Why, having so much, would he seem to be lusting after this piece of land? Mike Savoia. Right, exactly. As an immediate gain, if he could gain control of southern Syria and Palestine, he would control this very important nexus of trading routes, and of course gain access to the Red Sea and therefore be able to tap that as well. And then as a longer range project, it would put him in a good strong position to conquer Egypt, which was a land of fabulous wealth, you see, and therefore eliminate these two competing empires and just absorb it all into his own. So you see, this was his long range plan. And so you might say that this was not a secret. This was something, because of his extended preparations beginning in about 210 BC, you know, this the pressure on the border with the Ptolemaic kingdom began to be quite evident. The high priest in Judea, and those, of course, working very closely with him in the civil administration of Judea, had to recognize that there was a good chance they might have a change in rulership, that they might not long continue to be part of the Ptolemaic Empire, especially since the Seleucid Empire kept getting stronger and stronger and stronger, and at the same time, the Ptolemaic kingdom was getting weaker and weaker and weaker. It wasn't just that one was getting stronger and the other was holding steady. One was getting stronger and the other was clearly in decline. And therefore, that sort of indicated that that would provide a powerful temptation for Antiochus to take over southern Syria and Palestine. Okay. Put yourself into the shoes of the high priest and his top advisors. You are facing the reality that you will have a change in rulership. If that happens, where do you fit in this administrative framework? Joey? Why? Do they have a king?
No, they have a leader already.
Okay, but they don't have a king, do they? No, so they don't quite fit that. Why else don't they quite fit that, despite the truth of what Joey said? Bill? What proportion were living in Judea, would you estimate? Probably 10, the outside 15%, but probably closer to 10% of the Jews were living in Judea, you see. Many of them never ever left Babylon, or in that general area. Some were actually living in Egypt itself. And to when do we date this Jewish community in Egypt? When was it established, you might say, in Egypt? At what period? You know, if you had to go back a ways, but when do we date this, the beginnings of this Egyptian Jewish community here? To what event? Barat?
Around the 250s?
No, you go back much earlier than that. Probably was swelled by that, because why did you pick that number? Does anybody know why he picked 250 BC? Shame on you. 250 BC, the traditional date for a very momentous event, studied undoubtedly in biblical scholarship in the second semester of systematic theology. What do you call that course now? Fundamentals of Theology. Alan? Yeah. And why, what did the Septuagint have to be translated?
There were a lot of these
Yeah. Also, the ruler of Egypt wanted a copy of it for his library. And, of course, he couldn't read it in Hebrew anyway, so he wanted it in Greek. But partly one and partly the other. But to what... Now, undoubtedly, you know, that period was a period when there was a swelling of the population in Judea, rather in Egypt of the Jews. But when did that community get started? Is interesting. Okay, I mean, don't get bent out of shape if you don't know, but it's just interesting to me. Richard? Yeah, because when, remember those people fled from Judea after having murdered the governor, Gedaliah, and they dragged Jeremiah down there with him? You see, they did plant the seeds of a Jewish community, which remained small, but then through time did grow by accretion. What other event gives testimony of Jews living in Egypt, though not up in the north, but in the far south? Mark? Right, because there was a Jewish garrison down in Aswan. So you do have some there, but the bulk of them are still living in the area centered around Babylon, though some, of course, had migrated to other places throughout. Because how do we know? What book of the Bible tells us that after the fall of Babylon, that though the bulk of the Jews continued to live in the area of Babylon, I don't mean just the city, I mean the general province of Babylon, that they had moved around and spread around quite a bit? What book of the Bible gives us testimony of that fact, that they were very diverse, spread out very thoroughly throughout this area? Mrs. Reagan? Well, no, that's still dealing with the period of the conquest. They weren't that spread out then. They were still concentrated mainly in Babylon in that time. Mr. Uda? Right. See, one of the things that was the most telling part of the charge that Haman made about the Jews is not just that they don't obey the king's laws, because they obey, they have their own, but these people are spread out in every province of your empire. Now, allow for a little bit of exaggeration, that maybe it wasn't literally every part of his empire. But that's the point that made it such a telling charge. He says their disobedience is visible to people everywhere in your empire. You know, and you don't want that kind of an example being set everywhere in your empire. And so he induced the king to let him destroy them. So we have testimony that by the time, let's say, of Xerxes, who we think is Ahasuerus, which may or may not be correct, there's still a lot of debate about that, but most people feel he was the emperor Xerxes, that the Jews were pretty much spread throughout much of this area, you see. And so you do have a compact unit with a restored national life in Judea, but the bulk of the Jews are elsewhere, you see. So you couldn't really classify them as a vassal kingdom. They would have to be classified here, because this is where they most closely fit. They do not have a king. They are spread out over large portions of the empire. And so if they moved into the Seleucid rulership, that's what they would have to look for as their way they would be treated by the Seleucid ruler. See? Now, why would that not be desirable from the point of view of the high priest and his associates? Mm-hmm. And what else would be true? I didn't write it on the board, but I just did it verbally because I ran out of space. Randy? Right. What else would be lost? I mean, what specific advantage, Art? Mm-hmm. What else? Dan?
Well, there's a lot of trading rights. So,
well, what trading rights did they have?
Port. I would imagine since that's such a strategic area, they're traveling up and down
the highway. Yeah, but these trading perks are reserved for Hellenistic cities. They didn't have any special privileges in that respect. They might have been in a strategic location, but they couldn't take much advantage of it. Those who were members of Hellenistic cities got the opportunity to exploit those routes. I'm sorry, no, I mean the Ptolemaic Empire, no, the Ptolemies themselves did that. The routes that went through Judea. But something they had under the Ptolemies would not be theirs under this classification, something very, very important. What is it that we're missing? Dan? Yeah. They would have to, they would not control their own legislation, which was religiously based. They would not be able to necessarily maintain their own cultural autonomy. They would be put under a great deal of this pressure of Hellenization. And they would lose all self-government. You see, these people had no self-government, those in the people area. These had guarantees of total internal self-government by charter. These had considerable areas of self-government, but not total, the number two. These people had no power of self-government. They were directly ruled by the Seleucids. And so this was quite disturbing to the high priest and his associates. What they hoped for then was that they could manage to do something important at the critical moment of the change in power. When the Seleucid king attacked, if they could render significant aid, you see, to the king at that time, they might be able to buy as a reward recognition of themselves as a separate group, not to be put into the normal administrative machinery, but treated as a separate group with guarantees for their autonomy, self-government, and the leadership of the high priest. Now, they obviously didn't want to wait until the attack, because otherwise the Seleucid king wouldn't even know what was in their mind. It was important he know in advance that he could count on their assistance, and that they really were siding with him in this upcoming struggle. So they needed to let him become aware of this. Now, what's one thing they could not do as they tried to make the Seleucid ruler aware of the fact that they were supportive of his designs and were standing ready to assist him when the moment of conflict came? I mean, what's something they could not do? Flavia? Now, this would be viewed as high treason, you know, and the high priest would have been removed, and the Ptolemies might have even scrapped their temple land status because of this high treason and just taken them over brutally. And so what they did is, while maintaining a public policy that was pro-Ptolemaic, they maintained a public policy that was pro-Ptolemaic, intensely loyal to the existing administration. And very visible in this group, of course, was the high priest. He was very visible in this role, a visible leader of this policy. But while maintaining that public policy, they maintained a secret, or if you want to use a fancy word, sub rosa policy that was pro-Seleucid. Now, the high priest could not afford to take the risk of being directly connected with this secret policy, because if there were any leaks, you know, that could be very compromising. And so he had a surrogate as the head of this policy. And this surrogate was in communication with Antiochus III, reassuring him that Judea was looking forward to him taking over the area, and they would view that as a very positive step, and they stood ready to assist him in whatever way they could, and they could count on them to do their best when he launched his attack. While at the same time, the high priest is maintaining the facade of full loyalty to the Ptolemaic ruler. Now, do you approve, or do you have any other comments about this approach to their problem? Don? Aha, right to the nexus of the problem. Excellent. This is a totally worldly approach to their problem, because their motivation was good. They wanted to be able to continue to live by the laws God had legislated. They did not want to be forced to adopt foreign ways, to be forced to admit foreign cultural influences which would water down their religion. But they were using a totally physical approach to their problem. Instead of seeking God and increasing their contact with God and their loyalty to His ways, and then hoping in faith to receive His protection when this thing took place. That would have been the right approach. To rely on God in faith to work it out, you know, that things would still work out. But they were walking totally by sight and not at all by faith. Now, what happened is this. You see, they had to be very careful that this thing was going to work. Not only could they have to keep their true intentions secret, but if they waited too long after the invasion to render help, the help would have been of no consequence. If they waited until the victory was clearly Antiochus's, he could say to them, well, now you offer help. I don't need any help. I'm in charge now. I mean, I have just mopping up to do, but, you know, you haven't done anything to merit any consideration. They have to be very quick to offer their assistance while the issue is still in doubt, so their assistance is seen as being crucial to the success. So then the king feels he owes them something, and then they can, you know, get what they want. There's one problem with this, however. You know, this is a delicate matter of timing. You want to wait long enough to make sure this is the real attack that's going to succeed before you jump on the bandwagon, but you can't afford to wait too long when the need for your help is no longer there. You're going to have to gauge this thing very quickly as to, is this the appropriate time to declare ourselves openly where our sympathies are? Or are we going to be left stranded up on the beach when the tide goes out, fully exposed to the wrath of the Ptolemies? This is what was a problem. Dan, you had a comment or a question? Okay. Now what happened is that the Seleucids, without communicating, of course, with the Jewish leaders, because they had no need to, and the Jewish leaders had no right to expect it, did begin an attack against southern Syria. But it was not meant to be a major attack. It was simply a probe of how good were the Ptolemaic defenses in that area. They wanted to assess how much they would really need to really break through. But the high priest of that period, whose name was Onias II, a very important individual in terms of this period, he mistook this probe for the real thing. And he openly declared his pro-Seleucid loyalties. And to back up that protestation of pro-Seleucid loyalty, since it was the appropriate time of the year by coincidence when he was supposed to send the tribute payment to the Ptolemies in Egypt, he sent a message saying, forget it, you're not getting it. In other words, he went way out on a limb, fully convinced that this probe by the Seleucids was the real thing. And it wasn't. The Seleucid troops withdrew once they had learned what they needed to learn. And there was Onias II high and dry, having openly declared his and Judea's loyalty to the Seleucids. They were really in a tight spot. What happened at this particular point in time is the man who was the Ptolemaic governor of Ammon. Here is Ammon. The man who was the Ptolemaic governor of Ammon was, interestingly enough, a descendant of Nehemiah's old foe, Tobiah. That family had proved to be remarkably nimble. They had served the Persians and managed to be appointed a governor of Ammon by Alexander the Great, and then had managed to be appointed governor of Ammon by the Ptolemies who succeeded Alexander. They were very wily and politically astute family. And so they were still around as governors of Ammon. This particular governor, his name was Joseph, not to be confused with the biblical Joseph by any stretch of the imagination, pulled Onias out of the fire to an extent by going down to Egypt and paying the tribute out of his own funds, which he had enough to draw upon, paying the tribute out of his own funds, and telling the Ptolemaic ruler of Egypt, he says, look, don't assume that all the people of Judea, or even the top leadership of Judea, is against you and is pro-Seleucid. It's just that Onias. This thing was his own doing. And the real sympathies of the people are with you. And as proof of that, they have sent me with their money, which they want paid to you as a sign of their loyalty. He didn't tell them it was his own money. He told them it was the people of Judea who were sending him with the money. And so as a reward, Joseph was made effective civil ruler of Judea and tax farmer for Judea. Onias was retained as high priest, but the area of Judea was no longer considered temple land by the Ptolemies because of his act of rebellion. And so Joseph, someone who is not the high priest, is appointed as the civil head of Judea, and he is given the right to become the tax farmer for Judea. Okay, you can wrap this up very quickly. In 198 B.C., the real attack came. And the Jews very quickly rendered significant assistance to the Seleucid ruler, Antiochus III. Because as part of this penalty, not only was Joseph the civil ruler and tax farmer, but because the Ptolemaic ruler didn't really trust the Jews, he had put a garrison of troops in Jerusalem. You see, he had garrisoned Jerusalem with his own troops. But what the Jews did was they neutralized that garrison in Jerusalem, and they gave all kinds of foodstuffs and other vital supplies to Antiochus to assist him in his invasion. And Antiochus did recognize they had rendered significant material support. They came in at the right time with the right kind of support, greatly assisting his invasion. And Antiochus was in a mood to be very grateful and generous with the Jews because of their support. And therefore, he said, they would continue to enjoy their traditional autonomies because they had pleased him by their actions. That he didn't use the category of temple land, he still regarded Onias II as the civil head of things in Judea, because after all, he had gone public even earlier, you see, with his sympathies. He was restored as the civil head of Judea. He said that they would be free to practice their religion without any interference, and they could obey their own laws, their own cultural traditions, because they had pleased him. Did they manage then to successfully endure this time period? Or is there still something that's not quite the same? Do you see the subtle difference? What do you see that's different? Looks the same. High priest is still in power, still the civil head. They still are allowed to practice their religion without interference, obey their religiously derived laws without having to adopt Seleucid laws, still practice their own unique culture. But what's the difference? Monica? Okay, but that's minor. There's still a big, 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 big difference. Eric?
Yeah, well,
that's another problem. But they sensed that they were in a weaker position, the rulership. Despite the fact things looked like they were the same, essentially, they were in a much weaker position. Why? Go ahead. Ken? Well, I mean, the high priest was still their civil ruler. He had been that before. No, Joseph had been, but the Seleucid ruler had gotten rid of Joseph and had put in back Onias, you see. That was restored. Perot?
Wasn't that this was maybe a temporary favor and some other ruler came up and died?
You see, there was no guarantee of that. Under the Ptolemies, they had their autonomy because they fit into a certain part of the administrative structure. It was sort of the consequence of being temple land. Here, this autonomy rested on the goodwill of this particular ruler. What if he later didn't have such goodwill towards them? It was at his pleasure they enjoyed this autonomy. And when the next ruler came on the scene, would he continue that? Or would he look at them differently? You see, it's a very shaky thing. You can look at it this way, that under the Ptolemies, their autonomy rested on a foundation, a rock foundation. A solid foundation of rock. Their classification is temple land. Now, their autonomy was on the sand, founded on the sand of the present goodwill of this particular ruler. You can see why I'm comparing it to sand, because either one could disappear. This ruler could be replaced by another who would say, I don't owe these people anything. They didn't do anything for me, you see. Or this ruler could change his mind too. So they are in a much weaker position. Okay, I'll put you back and leave you as the high priest and his cabinet of advisors. What do you do now? If you want to shore up your autonomy and guarantee it,